From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the first American commissioned officer to publicly refuse to deploy to Iraq, Lieutenant Aaron Ouattara. His reason? He says the war is illegal. His court-martial trial is next month. He faces 2 years for refusing to deploy and 4 years on charges of violating the Uniform Code of Military Justice for public statements he made opposing the war and criticizing the Bush administration. We'll also talk with Ouattara's civilian lawyer, Eric Seitz. The Army declined to participate in our program, but we'll talk about the military's position with Eugene Fidel, president of the National Institute of Military Justice. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lieutenant Aaron Ouattara, is the first American commissioned officer to publicly refuse to go to Iraq. His reason? He says he believes the war is illegal. His court-martial trial is scheduled to begin February 5th. If convicted for refusing to deploy, he faces up to 2 years in prison. He's also facing 4 charges of violating the Uniform Code of Military Justice for public statements he made opposing the war and criticizing the Bush administration. He could be sentenced to 4 years for those charges. Lieutenant Ouattara's court-martial trial will be held at Fort Lewis in Tacoma, Washington, where he's been on desk duty since refusing to deploy. Ouattara enlisted in 2003, and after completing officer's candidate school, was deployed to South Korea, where he served with distinction. Also joining us, by phone from Hawaii, where Ouattara grew up, is his civilian lawyer, Eric Seitz, who will enter into our conversation a little later. Lieutenant Ouattara, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you refuse to deploy to Iraq with your brigade?
Well, I think basically back in January of 2006, I sent an unofficial letter of resignation to my chain of command. Prior to that, I had started to do some research into the Iraq war based upon my responsibilities as a leader and an officer to prepare myself and also my soldiers for our pending deployment. And in that research, I began to look at the culture of Iraq, the history, the events on the ground, the conduct of the military and how the civilians were reacting to that, the nature of the insurgency and its causes, and also how we had gotten into the war in the first place. And I think I became very shocked at what I found, and that not only was the war illegal and immoral in of itself, but the conduct of the United States forces and the policy of the government were also very illegal and immoral. And I had to look at myself and ask myself the question of who I was in the military and what I was being asked to do. And I came to the conclusion that I could not, as an officer, as a soldier who has sworn an oath to protect the Constitution, the safety and the welfare of the American people, and uphold the treaties and laws that we were all beholden to, I could not condone or enable the leadership within our government who were enacting these illegal and immoral policies in Iraq.
You've used the words illegal and immoral. Can you briefly explain why you've used those words to describe the war?
Essentially, the war was started based upon false misrepresentations of the facts, of the justifications for going into Iraq. And to me, that is a basic violation of our separation of powers when you have one branch of government that is misleading the other branch of government in order to gain an authorization of force to invade another sovereign country. And not only that, but Article 6 of the Constitution specifically states that all international treaties that we enter into, that Congress ratifies, become the law of the land, second only to the Constitution. It is illegal under our Constitution and international law to invade and occupy another country that is not an imminent threat to us, or if this action is not authorized by the United Nations Security Council. The war is also illegal and immoral through its conduct, in that the United States military, through the rules of engagement and the policies, are violating international norms and laws daily. And that includes the illegal detention of Iraqi civilians and the mistreatment, abuse, and torture as a matter of policy, and also the mistreatment of civilians and the sieges of cities, the use of illegal weapons. All those things are violations of the Geneva Conventions, the Hague Convention, and many other humanitarian and international laws.
When you made your decision that you saw the war in Iraq as illegal and immoral, and you therefore did not want to deploy with your unit to Iraq, how did you go about refusing to deploy?
At first, I wrote a letter of resignation, a kind of informal letter, basically stating that I could not condone or enable something that I felt was contrary to my oath and my duty as a soldier. And I asked requestfully to resign my commission. And I was simply turned down at first. I was told that I would be kicked out of the unit and be transferred somewhere else. But then I was ordered to deploy on the unit's mission readiness exercise over to Fort Irwin, California. And then when I came back, I was transferred from a combat position on the line company to over into the battalion headquarters. I was offered the job of staying within the bases, I guess. I think they, at one point, they thought I was a conscientious objector, even though I had stated that I wasn't, and they were essentially offering me a safe position. And I said, no, that's not the point. I am against this war totally, not just because I'm a pacifist or a conscientious objector. And so I had turned down that offer, but they moved me anyway. And then they told me, they revoked my leave. The rest of the unit went on leave. And they said, by the time we come back, if you have not changed your decision, we will start legal proceedings. And when they said that, that's when I felt that I needed to have legal representation. And I asked Mr. Seitz if he would represent me. I had submitted an official resignation in April. It was turned down by the Department of the Army. I submitted another resignation through a different channel in late May, and that also was turned down. And when I saw that there was no other alternative, I believed that I needed to take this issue into the public arena and let the people know why soldiers were dying in Iraq and what their responsibilities were as Americans. And even after I was charged, we also offered to take non-judicial punishment. Well, I offered to take non-judicial punishment, meaning loss of rank and loss of pay, and while not admitting any guilt to anything. And I had, even before that, I had offered to deploy to Afghanistan in lieu of Iraq, and I was denied that as well because they said, if we let you go to Afghanistan, that means we would be admitting that there is something wrong with Iraq, and we believe there is nothing wrong with it.
But let me ask you, if they let you deploy to Afghanistan instead of Iraq, isn't that basically saying that officers can choose which country they want to fight in or which war they want to fight in, that somehow you have a choice and soldiers aren't supposed to have that kind of choice?
Well, I think we have to remember that we, as a country, including all of its citizens and the military, operate under the rule of law, and there is such thing as an illegal war, as determined after World War II. And soldiers, you're right, they don't have the right to pick and choose, but they have the duty and the obligation to determine if what they're being told to do, including deploying to a war, is illegal or not. And of course, that is also our right under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, military law. And every soldier who disobeys an order based that it's unlawful does so at his own peril. But if you are court-martialed and or if you face punishment over it, you should be allowed under the rule of law, in a court of law, to bring witnesses and evidence on your behalf that could testify to that order being unlawful. In this case, the judge has already predetermined that he will not allow any evidence or witnesses to testify that the war is illegal or immoral. He has already predetermined that the order is lawful. And in a sense, by charging me with missing movement, they are skirting the issue of the legality of the order. And they have also, they are also determining that the order to get on a plane is legal. And it has nothing to do with why you're getting on that plane or what are you going to do once you disembark. And I think that that's a disservice, because the order that I was given was to get on the transport to go to Iraq and conduct combat operations. And what I'm saying is the conduct of the combat operations in Iraq as a matter of policy and rules of engagement are violating the law and have been in the past.
My guest is Lieutenant Aaron Watada. He's being court-martialed for refusing to deploy to Iraq. His civilian lawyer, Eric Seitz, will join our conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lieutenant Aaron Watara. He's being court-martialed for refusing to deploy to Iraq. He says the war is illegal. He's also facing charges related to public statements he made opposing the war and criticizing the Bush administration. Also joining us by phone is his civilian lawyer, Eric Seitz. Eric Seitz, thank you for joining us. I know one of the arguments you wanted to make in the court-martial is that Lieutenant Watara, you know, refused to deploy to Iraq because the war is illegal. Illegal because the U.S. did not have the backing of the U.N. Security Council. But in January, a military judge ruled that you couldn't use that defense because the war's legality is a political question and not a question that could be judged in a military court. So where does that leave you in terms of the defense?
Well, as Aaron just said, basically the judge has predetermined the merits of the case, at least with respect to the missing movement charge. In addition to the missing movement charge, which carries a two-year maximum punishment and the equivalent of a dishonorable discharge from the Army, Aaron is also charged with four specifications, four additional charges of making statements that constitute conduct unbecoming of an officer. So although we will not be able to defend as to the legality of the war and the order, which he clearly violated, we certainly will be able to bring much of that evidence in with regard to the conduct unbecoming of an officer specifications, because that's very vague and ill-defined, and we believe that we're going to be allowed to raise many of those issues with regard to the specific statements that he's alleged to have made that are punishable.
Well, let me read the statements that Lieutenant Watara is being tried for. Statement one, I could never conceive of our leader betraying the trust we had in him. As I read about the level of deception the Bush administration used to initiate and process this war, I was shocked. I became ashamed of wearing the uniform. How can we wear something with such a time-honored tradition, knowing we waged war based on a misrepresentation and lies? It was a betrayal of the trust of the American people, and these lies were a betrayal of the trust of the military and the soldiers. But I felt there was nothing to be done, and this administration was just continually violating the law to serve their purpose, and there was nothing to stop them. Realizing the president is taking us into a war that he misled us about has broken that bond of trust that we had. If the president can betray my trust, it's time for me to evaluate what he's willing to tell me to do. Statement number two, I was shocked and at the same time ashamed that Bush had planned to invade Iraq before the 9/11 attacks. How could I wear this honorable uniform now, knowing we invaded a country for a lie? And statement three, it is my conclusion as an officer of the armed forces that the war in Iraq is not only morally wrong, but a horrible breach of American law. As the order to take part in an illegal act is ultimately unlawful as well, I must, as an officer of honor and integrity, refuse that order. The wholesale slaughter and mistreatment of Iraqis is not only a terrible and moral injustice, but it's a contradiction to the Army's own law of land warfare. My participation would make me party to war crimes. So Lieutenant Watara is accused of conduct unbecoming an officer for making those three statements. And let me last ask you, this is Lieutenant Watara's lawyer, Eric Seitz, how do you plan on defending him on those charges of conduct unbecoming?
Well, first of all, in the motions hearing that we had in January, we argued that the statements are perfectly permissible. There is certainly no doubt that even people on active duty in the military have the protection of the First Amendment, and we argued that those statements are nothing more than statements of a political nature which you hear on military bases or in barracks, and you've been hearing increasingly from military leaders, including several generals and other people who've been critical of policy in Iraq, so that he's being singled out for saying the same things which everybody is saying and which he's entitled to say. Now, the judge denied our motion to dismiss based upon that, and so now we're faced with the question of whether or not those charges and that language constitute conduct unbecoming of an officer, which typically involves adultery, writing bad checks, the kind of conduct which is clearly inconsistent with the moral obligations of somebody who's put into a position of responsibility. Our argument simply is going to be that in making those statements, Lieutenant Watara was in fact exercising all of the moral authority which he has to exercise as an officer in the military, and that it is entirely conduct becoming of an officer, and that more officers ought to be making those kinds of statements. So we are going to go right up against those charges, basically, and say that the statements that he made are not only true and responsible and thoughtful and sincere, but that they constitute carrying out the obligations which he was sworn to do.
Now, Lieutenant Watada, you made those statements to the press, and I believe at a demonstration. Is that right?
I made these comments to two reporters, and also at a press conference, in which that was when I first announced to the public the reasons why I was refusing deployment to Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Now, the judge in the pretrial hearing said that there are limits to the free speech rights of military personnel, and that a military panel should decide whether these criticisms of the war could have endangered the morale, loyalty, and discipline of troops. Eric Seitz, as a lawyer, what is your understanding of the limits to free speech for military personnel?
Let me answer that in two different ways. First of all, there is a misconception that when you put on a uniform and take an oath that you give up your rights, that you're sworn to protect for everybody else. And that's absolutely untrue. The limitations historically that have been applied by the courts, both military and civilian, to people in military service are that they cannot participate in activities in uniform which are not approved by their command. They cannot say contemptuous or disloyal things about the president or the secretary of defense or other leaders that would undermine discipline and authority specifically within their ranks, that they cannot represent themselves as spokespeople for the military when they're making statements of personal opinion in which they may be criticizing or opposing official views. And obviously, they cannot do the same kinds of things that you and I can't do. They cannot incite riots. They cannot incite violence. They cannot do those kinds of things which cross the line from speech to conduct and are impermissible for all of us as well. But short of that, they can criticize, they can make statements both publicly and privately, as long as they do it within those parameters. And so there's no question that Lieutenant Watada has a right to speak out on controversial issues. The question really is time, place, and manner, and in this situation, he certainly was very respectful in the way he expressed his views. The problem we have with the judge's ruling is that he's going to leave it up to a panel of officers as to whether or not this speech is permissible. And when this decision is reviewed by higher military courts and up to and including perhaps the Supreme Court of the United States, they are going to be appalled that the limits of free speech are going to be decided by military line officers, because that's not something that I think ought to be done.
But they're deciding the limits of free speech for the military, not for civilians.
They are, but it's really a question that the military judge should decide as a matter of law, because speech is something that's obviously very highly respected in our system of justice, and it's being left up to a number of people who have no training and obviously have biases and experiences from the offices that they hold. But there isn't going to be a single person on that panel who hasn't either been to Iraq or doesn't know people who've been to Iraq and are there now. And all of them probably also know people who have been killed or severely injured or wounded in Iraq. And so the presumption is that we're dealing with a body of people who are going to make a decision as to free speech, who come to this decision with very severe biases. And that's why we're very concerned that this is not really so much a justice proceeding but a disciplinary proceeding.
And what's the distinction between a justice and a disciplinary proceeding?
Well, if this were a court and a trial, we would be able to air the issues in a fairly defined manner. And we've been precluded from raising defenses. We've been told that all of our witnesses have been denied, that if we're not going to be allowed to call any of our witnesses. And so basically, the only real determination here is going to be not whether Lieutenant Watada is guilty or innocent of the charges against him, but what's the punishment going to be? And that's more in the nature of a disciplinary proceeding, which is, in fact, what military courts are set up to do.
So how much leeway do you have now in arguing Lieutenant Watada's defense?
Well, we're going to, as I said earlier, we're going to have some leeway with respect to arguing to these court members that he should not be punished for making statements which he's entitled to make. But I'm not overly confident that they're going to be sophisticated enough to make the distinctions that the law requires of them under those circumstances. And we're also going to be able to argue in any punishment phase of the case that he was very sincere, he was very thoughtful, he was very respectful, and that the kind of statements and the thought process that he's gone through is something that ought to be respected and not heavily punished. But that really is the extent to which we're going to be allowed to make those arguments.
What are the larger principles that you feel are on trial in this case?
First of all, I think that at the time that Aaron spoke out and that this began to unfold in June of this year, the war was going on, and the anti-war movement in this country was minimal at best, and I think that there was a lot of frustration on the part of people who realized what's been happening in Iraq and how horrendous it is, that there wasn't more outspokenness in opposition and more people putting themselves in positions where they were actually having an impact on whether or not this war could continue. I think it was pivotal for Aaron to speak out when he did, and I think to a certain degree we've seen a very significant change in public opinion in this country, in part because of the actions that he and a handful of other people have taken with enormous courage. And that really was reflected in the election results this last time around, and in a climate where now as many as 70 or 80% of the people in this country are calling for an end to this war and are criticizing the basis upon which it was initiated.
Lieutenant Aaron Watata's court-martial trial is scheduled for February 5th. We'll talk more with Lieutenant Watata and his lawyer, Eric Seitz, in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Army Lieutenant Aaron Watata and his lawyer Eric Seitz about Watata's upcoming court-martial trial, and we'll talk about the charges against Watata with Eugene Fidel of the National Institute of Military Justice. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Lieutenant Aaron Watata, the first American commissioned officer to refuse to go to Iraq. He says the war is illegal. His court-martial is scheduled for February 5th. He faces up to 2 years for refusing to deploy and 4 years for violating the Uniform Code of Military Justice in public statements he made opposing the war and criticizing the Bush administration. Also joining us by phone from Honolulu is Watata's civilian lawyer, Eric Seitz. Lieutenant Watata, you're at Fort Lewis, and that's in Tacoma. Do I have that right?
Yes.
And the Seattle Times, which is in the same area, The Seattle Times had an editorial about your case, and I want to read an excerpt of it. The editorial says, he, Lieutenant Watata, says he opposes the war. Not all wars, but this one. So do we. But we cannot support his request to be excused from a posting to Iraq. Soldiers have to go where they are ordered. That is the rule here and everywhere, and for reasons of military necessity. Watata was a volunteer and knew that when he signed up. He knew about the Iraq War as well. He signed up in 2003, the year of the U.S. invasion. He also should have known that once one joins the military, one loses the freedom to speak in ways that could damage soldiers' morale, a restriction that includes political criticism of the military's mission. And what this editorial recommends is convicting you on all charges and then giving you a dishonorable discharge. What's your reaction to what they say there, that you should have known that you had to obey orders and that the Army can't afford to let you get away with this, basically?
Well, the fact is that there is a higher law. When we join the military, we don't swear an oath to a person, or especially officers. In our oath, we do not swear an oath of loyalty to any one person or any group of people or even an institution. We swear an oath to protect the Constitution and also the American people as a whole. And we have to follow the rule of law as it says in the Constitution. And when I joined the military back in March 2003, I believed the administration when they said there was weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, there were ties with Saddam to Al-Qaeda and 9/11. We all know those things were false now. And there has been many reports coming out from former or retired CIA analysts and officers saying that the intelligence was not bad. It was intentionally falsified to fit the policy. And when we have, as I said, a group of people within our own government who mislead the public, who mislead the other branch of government in order to justify their war, that is a violation of the Constitution. And I have to say that regardless of what they convict me on, if they convict me or sentence me to, I am doing what I swore an oath to do when I joined the military 3 years ago. And as I said, I did not realize the extent of the deception that was waged upon us 3 years ago that I do now.
I know that some people listening to you are thinking that lieutenant is really just a coward. You know, he's hiding behind all this intellectual stuff, but really he just didn't want to risk his life in Iraq. I know some people are thinking that, so would you answer them?
Well, I think the more cowardly thing for me to do was to betray my own conscience and do something that I knew was totally wrong and order others to do that as well. And, you know, I'm facing some pretty serious consequences here. The fact that I will be going to prison for up to 6 years, I face a dishonorable discharge and all the ramifications that come from that. And I did not make this decision lightly.
So are you prepared to go to prison? I mean, are you trying to mentally prepare yourself in case that is the outcome?
You know, when we join the military, we say we will sacrifice whatever it takes to protect our country, the safety and the welfare of the American people, and our time-honored laws and traditions. And in some wars, and in some instances, even in the present, many men and women are sacrificing their lives and their bodies in order to uphold this belief. And I believe that I am doing the same thing. I'm sacrificing my freedom in order to uphold the same belief in our laws and our traditions and the safety and the welfare of the American people.
Now, there is a Japanese-American veterans group that is opposing you, and they're saying that you're bringing shame to the Japanese-American community by not following orders. What's your reaction to that criticism?
I think what's important to understand is there are individuals within these veterans groups who are opposed to what I'm doing, just as there are individuals within these groups who are very supportive. When I was in Hawaii, there was a gentleman who served in the 442nd Infantry Regiment in World War II, and he used to be the head of the organization. He is not anymore. And he told the head of the organization now, who had said publicly he was opposed to what I was doing, that he does not speak for all Japanese-American veterans.
You know, that's an interesting question, because the debate over Lieutenant Watata's position has really raged in the Japanese community. But it really has rekindled a debate that began during World War II when the Japanese were incarcerated as a race, and there was a debate as to whether or not they should defend the country that had put them in concentration camps. And that same debate has really raged in many respects now as a result of Aaron's actions. And frankly, from our standpoint, that's a good debate. And it certainly has been joined equally, as far as we can tell, on both sides. There are people who think that he should serve, and there are people that think that he shouldn't serve. But all of those people have had to examine the basis for this war and what it is that Aaron has been saying about why he isn't going to serve. And that's a good thing, because it has brought into the fray and into the discussion thousands and thousands of people who, up until the time that Aaron refused to go, have pretty much been silent.
Eric Seitz, let me ask you what the format will be of the court-martial trial on February 5th.
Well, we'll start out initially, as you do in any civilian trial, with a selection of the court members who are the military jury. And we will have the opportunity to question them individually to determine what their beliefs are and what their experiences are that they bring to bear in this case. Once a court is seated or impaneled, the government will then present its evidence, which in this case will take probably less than an hour or two, given the judge's rulings. And after that, we will have an opportunity to put on witnesses in defense, although they've denied all of our witnesses. So the extent to which we're going to be allowed to do that remains unclear. In all likelihood, Aaron will testify during that phase of the trial. And then after the court members make a determination as to the guilt or innocence on all of the pending charges, we will then have a punishment phase in front of the same court members, who will decide the ultimate punishment, to include the likelihood of a discharge from the Army and some period of incarceration.
What's the outcome you're hoping for?
Well, you know, with all due deference to the Seattle Times, if the Army were simply willing to discharge Aaron, we would take that. We've offered that a number of times. But they want to imprison him and make an example out of him. And that has not only to do with the fact that he dared to refuse an order to go to Iraq, but that he did it publicly and spoke out and has given the reasons for that. The Army is taking the position that they want him to serve a minimum of 18 months or longer. And I think when we get to trial, it's very likely that they're going to ask for 2 to 3 years at a minimum. Our hope is to minimize the consequences of this, because fundamentally, no one in the military, no one who's dealt personally with Aaron, believes that he's doing this to place himself out of danger. Everyone who's dealt with him, including his commanders, who respect his sincerity, feels that he's doing this as an act of conscience. So he's not a coward. He offered to go to Afghanistan. That really doesn't come into play here. He really is somebody who is conscientiously taking a position, and he should really be respected for that. If he's discharged, fine. If they feel he has to serve a short period of time, certainly less than what Lieutenant Calley served for being responsible for the massacre of people in Vietnam, we could live with that. But we can't live with a lengthy period of incarceration. We don't think that's called for in this situation.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Lieutenant Aaron Watata's court-martial is scheduled for February 5th. His lawyer, Eric Seitz, joined us by phone from Honolulu. We invited representatives of the Army to participate in our program, but the Army's Media Relations Office sent us this statement. Because First Lieutenant Watata's court-martial will begin early next month, it would be inappropriate to comment on his specific case. The Army has complete confidence in the military justice system and believes Lieutenant Watata will be given a fair trial. Coming up, we'll talk about the charges facing Watata with the president of the National Institute of Military Justice. This is Fresh Air. We've been talking about the upcoming court-martial of Lieutenant Erin Ouattara, the first American commissioned officer to refuse to deploy to Iraq. He says the war is illegal. He faces up to 2 years in prison for refusing to deploy. He also faces possible 4 years on charges of violating the Uniform Code of Military Justice in public statements he made opposing the war and criticizing the Bush administration. As I mentioned before, the Army declined to participate in our program. To better understand the charges, we called Eugene Fidel, the president of the National Institute of Military Justice, a nonprofit civilian group whose goal is to advance the fair administration of military justice and foster improved public understanding of the military justice system. It's affiliated with American University. Fidel served in the Coast Guard Reserve as a lieutenant commander. Eugene Fidel, welcome to Fresh Air. Lieutenant Ouattara is the first officer to refuse to deploy to Iraq because he thinks the war is illegal. He did offer to go to Afghanistan instead, but he refused a desk job in Iraq. Is there any legal precedent in the military for what he's doing?
No, there isn't. Not in the United States Armed Forces. Basically, officers and enlisted personnel don't have the option of choosing where they're going to serve. And to the extent that Lieutenant Ouattara effectively was trying to do that, it's not permitted under our system.
But, you know, Lieutenant Ouattara says that if you look at the Nuremberg principles, then an officer has an obligation to reject orders that he or she considers illegal. And the lieutenant is saying this war is illegal, so he has an obligation to not participate in it.
Well, there certainly is military law doctrine found in the Manual for Courts-Martial, which is the governing document here, for the proposition that a person has a defense to a charge of disobeying an order if the order is plainly unlawful or that a reasonable person would know was unlawful. And that simply doesn't apply in this situation. The law is that an order to deploy soldiers is a non-justiciable political question. Now, that's a fancy lawyer's term, but basically it means it's not for the criminal courts, in this case a court-martial, to decide what is effectively a political question. Deploying is different from performing some more ministerial act, some more isolated act. Do you shoot? Do you not shoot? Do you have a privilege to commit some other specific act in the course of military operations? That's very different from participation in the operation at all. And the law simply does not permit litigation of the legality of an overall military operation.
What's at stake for the military in that part of his case?
Well, not much, really. I think the military is probably on very firm ground in this respect. The military is not going to permit people to opt in or opt out unless they happen to be conscientious objectors. That's the escape valve in our military legal system. If a person's a conscientious objector, even a person who's already in, obviously, we don't have conscription these days, such a person can apply for what is called in-service conscientious objector status. And all the branches of the service have procedures for screening such applications and deciding whether the individual qualifies or doesn't qualify for separation or for transfer to non-combatant duties. In this case, Lieutenant Ouattara did not apply for conscientious objector status, and I believe the reason for that is that's not the nature of his objection. It's an objection to the legality of the war rather than an objection to participation in war in any form, which is the test for American conscientious objection.
So I think what you're saying, if I hear you correctly, is that Lieutenant Ouattara would have had grounds to stand on if he was saying, I refused to take this particular order or to give this particular order because I thought it violated the Nuremberg principles, but he can't refuse to deploy because of that.
That's exactly right. There is a defense to violation of orders. Under the Manual for Courts-Martial, it is a defense to any charge that the accused was acting pursuant to orders, unless the accused knew the orders to be unlawful or a person of ordinary sense and understanding would have known the orders to be unlawful. So military law does recognize a defense of obedience to orders, but the defense doesn't apply if the order is unlawful. That's the long and short of it. Now, that is applied to specific kinds of conduct. So, for example, an order to execute a prisoner, for example, would be a plainly illegal order. You have a duty to disregard such an order, to resist such an order. That's different from an order simply to deploy. That's the line that is involved in this case, and Lieutenant Watada falls on the wrong side of that line, it seems to me.
I bet there's absolutely nothing written about what the guidelines are if you think a war is illegal.
That's correct. Now, it does happen that there was a case in Germany, in the German armed forces, of an officer who objected to some kind of participation. He had an office job, and he was called upon to perform some duties in support of operations, I believe, in Iraq. And he objected because he felt the war in Iraq was illegal. That case went up through the court system in Germany, and the German court held that his preference to perform some other duty should have been honored. The long and short of it is, that's not the law in the United States.
Now, Lieutenant Watada is also being charged with conduct unbecoming because of the anti-war statements that he made to journalists and at a press conference. His lawyer says that conduct unbecoming is a charge usually applied to things like adultery or writing bad checks, not to anti-war statements. And his lawyer argues that this is really a First Amendment issue and that the lieutenant's conduct has not violated his oath as an officer. What's your understanding of how the charge of conduct unbecoming is being applied to Lieutenant Watada?
There are two provisions in the Uniform Code of Military Justice that are very flexible. One is the prohibition on conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. By the way, it also applies to women. And the other is conduct to the prejudice of good order and discipline or conduct that is service discrediting. Those two provisions, which are Articles 133 and 134 of the UCMJ, are extremely flexible. They cover a multitude of sins. For many years, there has been concern that they're too flexible and that they don't afford sufficient prior notice of what is criminal conduct and what isn't. In this particular case, I will say that my own view is the prosecution should not have cluttered the case up with issues relating to free speech. I'm not saying that the government will win or lose that. I think the government, they may have some problems with those charges. Had I been the prosecutor, I simply would have relied on the fact that Lieutenant Watada had failed to move with his unit, and that's quite an easy offense to prosecute, and it would have presented a much clearer case, a much simpler case, and would have avoided, at least possibly avoided, a number of the issues Lieutenant Watada is raising.
What's your understanding of the rights of an officer to free political speech? And what are the limitations on free speech when you serve as an officer on active duty in the military?
There's no question that military personnel, including officers, enjoy rights under the Bill of Rights, including the right to free speech. On the other hand, there's also no question that there are certain constraints that apply to military personnel. For example, Congress has said that military officers cannot speak contemptuously of the President of the United States or various other officials. You and I could speak however we want about the highest officials in the country without worrying about being thrown into jail. But a military officer cannot speak contemptuously without running the risk of being sent to jail. A famous case about this happened during the Vietnam War. There was an officer named Howe who was engaged in an anti-war protest, and he was carrying a picket sign that accused President Lyndon Johnson of being a fascist. Incidentally, he misspelled the word fascist, and I've always wondered whether that counted against him in the prosecution. So there are cases where military officers and military personnel generally have certain constraints on what they can say. Where that line is uncharted, and it's probably not chartable. These cases are notoriously fact-specific. We tend not to prosecute them because we don't have all that much vocal dissent within the armed services. People in the armed services today are not conscripts. They're all volunteers. They tend to be supporters of the program, and they tend to keep their views to themselves.
Now, the charges against him are seen by some as an attempt to silence opposition to the war that's coming from within the military. What would your response to that be?
I don't agree with that. I think there's a danger that prosecution can have a chilling effect. On the other hand, we really don't expect the military to play all that great a role in the political life of the country. There's great controversy, for example, when retired officers who are no longer wearing the uniform express their political views. For people who are still on active duty, it's much more sensitive. In our society, the culture is that we have civilian control of the military rather than the other way around. It's one of the strengths of our democracy. It calls for some self-restraint by military personnel. And happily, we very, very rarely get cases where we're forced to decide precisely where the boundary lies. That's a good thing, in my opinion.
My guest is Eugene Fidel, the president of the National Institute of Military Justice. We'll talk more about the upcoming court-martial of the first commissioned officer to refuse to deploy to Iraq after a break. This is Fresh Air. We've been talking about the upcoming court-martial of Lieutenant Aaron Ouattara. He refused to deploy to Iraq. He says the war is illegal. He faces up to 2 years for refusing to deploy and up to 4 years on charges related to public comments he made opposing the war and criticizing the Bush administration. We spoke to Ouattara earlier in the show. Let's get back to our conversation with Eugene Fidel, the president of the National Institute of Military Justice. Lieutenant Ouattara's lawyer expressed the concern that since Lieutenant Ouattara is facing a military jury, that the military jury may be biased against any kind of speech that opposes the military or the government that got us into the war. So is there that built-in bias in the system?
It's a fair concern, but the system also has some protections to prevent bias on the part of the jury. Specifically, there's an opportunity that the defense has to make sure that people aren't biased by asking them questions before the jury is seated. This is called voir dire examination. It can be fairly open-ended. The military judge will be presiding over that process, and the government also, by the way, will be able to ask some questions to make sure the jury is able to do its duty impartially and follow the judge's instructions. So the system has some protections against the danger of bias.
The lieutenant's lawyer says that they have been denied all of their witnesses that they wanted to call.
I believe the point they're making is that their Nuremberg defense has been thrown out by the judge as a matter of law. If you are seeking to call witnesses for the purpose of advancing a defense that has been decided by the judge not to have any merit as a legal matter, it's a waste of time to call witnesses.
So your understanding is that the reason why Lieutenant Ouattara can't use the Nuremberg defense to justify his refusal to go to Iraq is that you can't try in a military court whether a war is legal or not.
It's a political question. That's what the judge held, and the judge cited an earlier ruling of the United States Court of Appeals for that proposition. I think that ruling would probably be sustained, and given that ruling, no purpose is served by taking evidence, because if there's nothing there as a matter of law, why burden the court and the record with testimony that's irrelevant?
In what court would you decide whether a war was legal or not?
In no court at all. You'd decide it in Congress. The remedy for an illegal war is for Congress to either defund it, or if the initiation of the war is viewed as a high crime and misdemeanor, then there's a process in the Constitution.
for the charge of refusing to deploy to Iraq, Lieutenant Watada faces a possible 2-year sentence. But for the charges of conduct unbecoming, for public statements that he made in opposition to the war and how he got into the war, he faces 4 years. So a total of 6. Does that seem, in terms of military justice, like a lot of years for speech?
I could imagine speech that was so subversive of the national interest that it could conceivably be punished very severely. Whether this is too severe or not severe enough, I don't think we're in a position to say at the moment. Frankly, I don't think he's going to spend a lot of time in the stockade. I think he's going to be out fairly soon. No purpose is really served by keeping him for a prolonged period. But I do think that if he is convicted, he may well face some time in prison.
Well, the purpose would be in part maybe to set an example?
Yes, and that is a proper purpose of the military justice system. It's to punish, to deter, and to send a message.
What precedents might this court-martial set?
I think it's a case that if it's pursued straight through the process may lead to an interesting appellate decision, but I don't know that it's really plowing new ground. I think it's an interesting example of the limits of free speech in the military, and in a way, a useful reminder. So I think Lieutenant Watada has done the country a favor, but it may not be the favor that he intended. The favor that I think he's conferring is a reminder of the importance of civilian control of the military and of the, I think in many senses, salutary restraint that military personnel have shown over the years in terms of the public issues facing the country.
Eugene Fidel, thank you so much.
My privilege.
Eugene Fidel is the president of the National Institute of Military Justice. Earlier we heard from Lieutenant Aaron Watada and his lawyer. Watada's court-martial is scheduled for February 5th. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Ovid's The Metamorphoses, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from Anne and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching, at breakthroughcollaborative.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, an interview with Polish journalist Ryszard Kapuściński, who covered coups and revolutions in the developing world for 40 years. He died Tuesday at the age of 74. And we'll hear from Forrest Whitaker. He's nominated for an Oscar for his portrayal of Idi Amin in The Last King of Scotland. Join us for the next Fresh Air.